everyone. I'm Ethan Nasty Cat, and welcome to the fifth episode of Frequency Resonance Radio. Today was Tuesday, the 16th of August, 2016 EV. Currently, it is midnight 30. So it's 8 times 2, 8, 8 times 2. 8 is balance and power, ambition and determination. Astrologically, we had the Sun trine Uranus at 1623, encouraging original thought. Good, because that's tonight's subject. Also, at 1752, the Moon entered Aquarius, ruled by Uranus, allowing for freer play and work, as well as empowering technology. The Moon sextiled Mars at 1850, adding good vibrations to the air, and just sextiled Saturn at midnight 21. Before we start, I would like to express my sadness that the pioneer of televised political debate, John McLaughlin, died earlier today. Technically yesterday. I watch his shows often, and was always impressed by the diversity of opinion presented. To his memory and his brilliance, I would like to say, bye-bye. Now, on with the show. Now, the thing is that a lot of narrative these days, a lot of what we would consider modern mythology, a lot of modern stories are dominated by what is known as the hero's journey, which was outlined by Joseph Campbell in The Hero with a Thousand Faces. Now, there are a few problems with the hero's journey, but first I'd like to outline what exactly it is. The hero's journey comes in three stages with a few sub-stages each. The first stage is departure. There's the call to adventure, where beginning in normality, some information is presented to the hero to bring them to the unknown. Then the hero refuses the call out of obligation or fear. Then they commit to the quest for some reason, and their magical guide appears, often presenting the hero with some talisman or artifact that will be helpful later in their quest. Then they cross the threshold, they finally leave their limits and venture into the danger of the unknown. At this point, the hero is in the belly of the whale. The hero is cut off completely from the normal and the known, being swallowed completely by the unknown. The second stage is initiation, because, of course, the hero's journey is actually supposed to be modeled on both Jungian archetypes and shamanic rituals, shamanistic rituals of initiation. It's supposed to be universal in that aspect. I of course, doubt that universality for a few reasons. Not the universality of it as such, personally, but rather the specific structure in and of itself. The initiation consists of the Road of Trials, which is a series of tests that often come in threes. Threes, of course, are important. And often the hero fails at least one of them, but predominates anyway. Then there's the meeting with the goddess, in which the hero experiences an almighty, powerful, unconditional, absolute motherly love, often represented by the hero meeting their soulmate. Then, of course, the darker side appears with the woman as temptress, where the hero is tempted by pleasures intended to lead them away from their quest. Now, this temptress may not be a woman. This temptress may actually be a man, or just sort of a concept, really. All it has to be is some sort of figure that distracts the hero from their quest by means of offering materialism and pleasure and whatnot. After they're tempted, they get away from that, and they go on to the Atonement with the Father phase, in which the hero must confront a father-type figure who controls life and death. They must confront this figure and be initiated by this same figure. This actually reminds me of something I read in an excerpt from Daniel Pinchpeck's Breaking Open the Head, in which he describes the experience of this guy on the psychedelic drug DPT, which is actually a modification of DMT, but quasi-legal at the time that he wrote it, at least. And the basic idea was that the guy met a father who was pretty much obviously God, and he immediately started talking with this God figure, this father God figure, and then he said he was handed a Torah, which was a symbol of forgiveness and uniting and union. Non-dualism, essentially. So the Torah represented forgiveness and non-dual consciousness, I guess. At this point, there is the apotheosis after the atonement. The hero dies either literally or metaphorically, of course, and is resurrected, again, either literally or metaphorically. And then, after the apotheosis, there is the ultimate boon. The hero achieves their objective. This is the finding the truth, finding the Holy Grail, finding the Philosopher's Stone, finding the Elixir of Life, the Fountain of Eternal Youth, whatever it is, etc., etc. The hero is, at this point, at peace. But, of course, given that this is a story, there has to be the return. The hero might not want to come home. This is known as the refusal of the return. They found bliss. They want to keep it that way. So why would they want to return? That would make no sense. Of course, this means that the hero has not completely overcome ego and whatnot. So they selfishly want to exist in bliss forever without ever really pausing to think about bringing bliss back to other people. Now, hold on a sec. I have a book, How to Know Higher Worlds by Rudolf Steiner, that explains a little of this in a little more detail. Okay, so from How to Know Higher Worlds by Rudolf Steiner, I have Chapter 1, Paragraph 14, and it says, "One fundamental principle of esoteric science taught in every form of schooling must never be violated if we wish to achieve our goal. Every insight that you seek only to enrich your own store of learning and to accumulate treasure for yourself alone leads you from your path, but every insight that you seek in order to become more mature on the path of the ennoblement of humanity and world evolution brings you one step forward. This fundamental law must always be observed. Only if we make it the guiding principle of our lives can we call ourselves genuine seekers after a higher knowledge." So here, Steiner presents that idea very much in a plain English fashion. I mean, originally it was in German, but here he presents it very well, emphasizing the need to bring your knowledge to the rest of the world for everybody's benefit, not just your own. And of course, Philip K. Dick himself wrote an essay in his exegesis called The 10 Major Principles of the Gnostic Revelation. The third principle is, there is another better realm of God, and all our efforts are to be directed toward A, returning there, of course, which is the initiation phase, and B, bringing it here, which is, in the hero's journey, the return phase. So yes, after the hero finds their bliss and finds also the will to return, there is what is called by Joseph Campbell the magic flight, in which the hero must escape with that ultimate boon. The return itself may be just as dangerous as the original journey. So after that magical flight, there's the rescue from without. If the hero has been weakened, this is of course not always there, but oftentimes it is. If the hero has been weakened, they must have some kind of outside assistance to get them to return. So, with the return, there's the crossing of the return threshold. the hero must retain the wisdom gained on the quest and integrate it into their normal life and share it with the rest of their own world. At this point, the hero becomes the master of two worlds. The hero's balanced between the material and the spiritual, one could say, competent in both normalcy and the land of the quest, in other words. And at that point, the hero has freedom to live. The hero is no longer afraid of death, and as we all know, the fear of death is the fear of life. So overcoming the fear of death overcomes the fear of life itself, meaning that the hero lets themselves live in dhyana, or samadhi, technically, actually, samadhi, essentially, for the rest of their life. Now, of course, there are way too many flaws with this hero's journey model to even contemplate. Let's start with the criticism of vagueness. Leslie Northup says that mainstream comparative mythology has moved away from generalizing and universalizing categories, such as that of the hero's journey. I'm not necessarily in agreement with the idea that there shouldn't be a universalizing category, but definitely there should not be so much generalizing. His version of the hero's journey is very much Eurocentric, and it is not always found in every culture. It is found in plenty of cultures, but not all of them, definitely. Alan Dundas says it's not universal. He says, like most universalists, he is content to merely assert universality rather than bother to document it. If Campbell's generalizations about myth are not substantiated, why should students consider his work? Now, of course, I'm inclined to both agree and disagree with Dundas here. He has documented plenty of universality, but oftentimes this universality does not match up with his vision of the hero's journey. Oftentimes people come from different traditions, so it's not necessarily the truth for all traditions. As a matter of fact, even though it's supposed to be a shamanistic initiation metaphor, it doesn't fit up with that a lot of the time. So, what is needed is a true initiation metaphor structure that escapes the problems of the hero's journey. So, of course, there's another criticism of the hero's journey, one that I find incredibly compelling. It's specifically about Star Wars, which was directly based on Campbell's The Hero with a Thousand Faces. So, David Brin of Salon says that in contrast with Star Trek, which presents its heroes as normal but very competent humans who depend on each other and try their best to spread good to everyone, the lessons of Star Wars and the hero's journey monomyth template in general are elites have an inherent right to arbitrary rule. I'm quoting from him directly. Common citizens needn't be consulted. They may only choose which elite to follow. Good elites should act on their subjective whims without evidence, argument, or accountability. Any amount of sin can be forgiven if you are important enough. True leaders are born, it's genetic, the right to rule is inherited. Now, there's a major problem with that idea, of course. The whole genetic superiority argument I've covered in the alt-right, and I'm going to cover plenty of times because the whole divine right of kings thing is based on this sort of pseudo-racialism and whatnot, and also through some very weird and unfortunate esoteric negativity. And finally, his final point that the hero's journey says is justified human emotions like anger and sadness and grief and whatnot can turn a good person evil. So, of course, there are alternatives to the hero's journey that avoid a lot of the traps it has. Like, for instance, one of the most interesting ones of them all is the Japanese and general East Asian classical structure, Kisho Tenketsu, which purports to be able to tell a story without conflict, and my, does it succeed? Okay, so here's what the Kisho Tenketsu is. There's the ki, which is the introduction, which consists of the topics, the characters, the setting, etc., all this. These are introduced to the reader, or listener, or viewer, whatever. Then there's the sho, which is the development sho. What is introduced is expanded on. It's analyzed, it's synthesized. There are numbers of ways to go around with the development of the introduction. Then, here's the really weird part that is completely foreign to American audiences. There's the twist. Another topic surfaces out of nowhere, letting it climax. Now, most of us are familiar with the idea of the plot twist, but this is the plot twist on an entirely other level. Another entirely different topic out of nowhere. I mean, this can be an entirely different, like, if you're setting the characters and whatnot in one city, then it may suddenly turn to a different city, a different era, a different period, all these different kinds of things. And then finally, the ketsu, the conclusion, synthesizes the other three parts into a true ending. So, you know, I have to improvise. This gives me a really good chance to improvise on what I can do with this structure, the Kisho Tenketsu. Okay, so there are some girls, and they're chatting on a rainy day. Let's call them Leslie, Kira, and Ashley. Leslie, Kira, and Ashley. Okay, so Leslie, Kira, and Ashley are chatting. They're talking about nothing in general. And so they start to really start talking more in depth. Some sort of topic causes them to start introspecting, and they start to share sad things with each other. Leslie shares her feelings of abandonment. Kira shares her problems with her parents. Ashley shares her trouble with her money situation in the family and whatnot. So their boyfriends, their respective boyfriends, are all chatting themselves, coincidentally enough. And they start talking about their girlfriend's problems that they've confided in them. And they decide that they all have problems of their own, and they decide to embrace, and the girls themselves embrace each other in a feeling of mutual empathy. So that's my idea of how Kisho Tenketsu can go. That's a pretty satisfying plot, even if it has no real conflict in it. There are other structures now, besides Kisho Tenketsu and the hero's journey. There's the Norse structure, the general Norse structure. Generally speaking, the Norse structure involves three or four main heroes, and they all have a ritual, and then they go their own ways. And there are generally five acts for each protagonist. Each time an act closes and a new act begins, they meet each other, they discuss, and they have the same ritual, and finally it ends with them discussing all things, synthesizing everything around the ritual. There's a bunch of Indian structures, but what a lot of them hold in common. Just look at a Bollywood film. One moment it's action, one moment it's romance, one minute it's drama, next moment you're having a musical, for crying out loud. Generally speaking, however, most Indian narrative structures start with an invocation, a sacred ritual invocation, either metaphorically or literally. Again, there's a lot of metaphor and literalness in narrative structure. Generally speaking, narrative structure aims to represent inner conflict, inner soul conflict, through the outward conflict. This invocation will establish the tone for the story. Then, of course, the protagonist or the protagonists wander through several perspectives and ideas. It's very disjointed. It may not be even linear, sort of like Pulp Fiction, but as all these perspectives and ideas are wandered through by the characters, they all come together at the end. They're synthesized, and they repeat the original invocation, except this time it's transformed. It's a transformed invocation with new ideas. Then we get to the really interesting Central African structure, which is pretty much, you could say, given that it comes from neither the Indo-European nor East Asian cultures, which are both basically Eurasian cultures, Central African plot structures generally tend to be about a protagonist who is surrounded and kept in check by their environment, their social context, and, of course, the transcendent spiritual center. And all the action of the story happens within these surroundings, the environment, context, and spirituality. And instead of being based on functions of how the character behaves, what kind of conflicts the character gets into, etc., it's theme-based and it's relation-based. It's about how the character interacts. It's about what the character is thinking rather than what the character is doing and how they're doing it, and conquest and whatnot. I very much admire that. And then, finally, we have the amazing autochthonous structure, where I can't really even begin to describe the actual structure itself, but everything is basically symbols and plot without a true story. I haven't really seen many examples of this. I guess you could say the novel Wittgenstein's Mistress by David Markson is very much an autochthonous novel. Samuel Beckett's stuff often reflects this kind of structure as well. So here we have a ton of different structures, a ton of alternatives to the outworn hero's journey structure. And I must point out, as a matter of fact, that one of the problems with the hero's journey is that it's suited very much to the age of Pisces, which we're transitioning from. We're moving toward the age of Aquarius at this point. So we need a new Aquarian monomyth, not the old established Piscean monomyth. And this is where things get tricky. So I've relied upon my sources from Gurdjieff and Steiner to develop sort of what I would call a new monomyth, this one for the age of Aquarius rather than for Pisces. The age of the Holy Spirit, you could say, instead of the age of the sun. So here we have complacency. At first, the hero is complacent. We see the hero. We see the hero's setting, where they are, whence they are, etc. And, of course, the main themes are foreshadowed. But instead of having a call to adventure, which they then resist, they're thrust into adventure. Suddenly, out of nowhere, the hero is in the adventure. They can't resist because they are in this adventure of their own excuse me, they're in this adventure through no volition of their own. There is no possibility to say, no thanks, I'm going to stay at Bag's End. Then the hero starts wandering after they're thrust into this journey. They're overcome with doubt. They don't know what they're really doing. They meander about. They start gaining knowledge along the way. They meet a lot of characters. They meet a lot of new, interesting people, all of which have a pearl of wisdom to impart to the protagonist, the hero. And then, with all this knowledge, they finally find the path. They overcome this doubt that they have, and they set upon the staircase, as Muravyev would put it. They find the true path, and they start to follow it. As they follow the path, they meet with the divine. They meet with a father and mother figure. So this could be the god or the goddess, or both the god and goddess, who imparts on them wisdom and gives them their true objective. Now, this is the moment that really transforms the story from a simple journey to an epic quest. Then we have the hero entering the unknown. This is where they cut off their connection with their former life, and they plunge into the other world. The other world being whatever unknown or dangerous place they're in, whether literal or metaphorical. So this is where they confront the real unknown, the absurd, you could say. The journey continues, and then they finally confront the Guardian. This is the first part of the real climax, and the confrontation with the Guardian is where the hero finds the antagonist. This antagonist doesn't necessarily have to be a person, it doesn't necessarily have to be a creature, it can be an inanimate object, and can be anything that blocks the hero from obtaining what you can call divinity, from what you can call knowledge or truth or whatnot, and defeats it. And then there's the sacrifice. Due to the previous confrontation, the hero is weakened. They lose some symbol of themselves, but they also gain a sort of gnosis, a sort of transcendental truth that enables them to overcome their previous issues. Now, there's also the return with help. Using their own newfound true will and their connections with all the other characters they've met, especially the greatest and the bravest and the wisest, they get to return to their origin setting. And now the hero is the master and the teacher. Now at home, the hero brings back the true wisdom they have learned and gained, and they share it with their comrades at home. This is what Philip K. Dick meant by getting there and bringing as much of it as possible back here. This is the good for all mankind that Rudolf Steiner spoke about in How to Know Higher Worlds in the very first chapter. So this is the monomyth I would like to present to the new age, the new generation, and I really hope that there are more stories that are created using innovations. It doesn't even necessarily have to be my own innovation that I just presented. It can be any innovation. I mean, it would be awesome to read a long novel that's even just based on Kisho Tenketsu. As a matter of fact, the most awesome thing of all would be to fuse this new monomyth with the Central African structure and the Indian structure and the Norse structure and the Kisho Tenketsu as much as humanly possible. So, speaking of Steiner, now yet again, Remember for the month that compassion becomes freedom. And whenever you see someone suffering, whether it's grieving, whether it's loss, whether they're on the brink of death or whatnot, express love toward them. And this will definitely, I guarantee it, this will lead to liberation for both of you. So thank you for listening, everyone. Hopefully some more original stories will begin to be made. Don't forget to patronize me on Patreon or donate to my donor box, whichever one floats your boat. Please tune in Friday for some more ideas, or perhaps, hopefully, an interview. So good night and love and light.